We good? Oh yeah, we're good. The light is green. I hate to cut him off. 6 more minutes left in the song. I'm sorry. We'll play it if we don't have enough questions at the end. All right, I promise. So my name is Jeff Stokes, and I work for Microsoft, and this is Advanced VDI Optimization. I'd like to thank everyone for coming. We're going to talk about something that's near and dear to my heart, which is user experience. And it's kind of my philosophy that when you look at an implementation of any IT solution, the part that kind of gets cast aside, or at least used to get cast aside, was kind of the end user experience. You know, you'd put in this $10 million SAN and a redundant network and high speed this and all this stuff. And then you'd nickel and dime the vendor and get a $400 laptop for them and wonder why they hate you, right? So I spent 4 or 5 years at Microsoft doing Windows desktop risk assessments where I analyzed situations just like that and had to explain why a 4200 RPM hard drive with 2 gig of RAM in a Celeron processor wasn't really what the user wanted, you know? And then two different monitoring softwares watching each other and the end user just sort of exacerbated things, and you know, the end user experience just wasn't there. So in my opinion, and this is Jeff's opinion, BYOD to some extent is the rebellion of the user from this kind of experience, and that's where VDI comes in. As we have users that bring in their own equipment, or they sort of pick and choose from devices, or they won't have access to data anywhere, it behooves us to lock some things down. I mean, it's cool that we let someone use a tablet, but it's not cool that it gets left at the airport and all of our data gets taken away, right? So how do we work around that? How do we engineer? Well, virtual desktops is certainly a solution for that. Remote desktop is as well, but this is going to focus mainly on VDI solutions, the virtual desktop hosted desktops, right? A little bit about me. I have 20 years of experience in IT, give or take. I got my start at DEC, if anyone remembers that, the DEC Alpha, and did some dot-coms, Earthlink, ING, and then Microsoft for a while, and it's been a fun ride. I blog at the Ask PFE Plat. I recommend you taking a look at it if you haven't done so already. There's a lot of good articles up there. We try and do 2 or 3 a week. And then I have a Twitter account that I pretend I know how to use, so I'm not quite that generation. I'm all about kids, pugs, and hip-hop. You wouldn't know it because I played Duane Allman, but you know, Public Enemy isn't really clean for this crowd, so I had to make a concession there. So, VDI optimization. We're going to talk about some of the improvements in Windows 8.1 and Windows Server 2012 R2. There are some performance and reliability updates. There are some new features that have come out that are pretty handy with Update 1. There are some changes that maybe you're aware of where Update 1 is required as a servicing stack update, or you'll stop getting security hotfixes come soon. So hopefully you're all aware of that. And then we'll talk about some configuration and build guidance. Bless you. We're going to talk about the thick-thin hybrid model and then how that kind of interacts with the persistent, non-persistent pooled virtual desktop environment. We'll talk a little bit about application provisioning, and then there's a lot of guidance out there on the internet on how to do virtual desktops, and some of this is vendor specific. You know, if you're a VMware shop, you might want to listen to what the VMware folks have to say. But I find that a lot of people, when they implement VDI, tend to follow religiously the doctrine of the vendor, and sometimes it gets you into trouble because that doctrine is made to make the vendor look the best. So you end up turning off things that are important to Windows so you can squeeze a couple extra, you know, clones into the stack. And that's really not a good way to do things. So we're going to talk about some of the configuration guidance over the years and what we would support, right? And then we're going to talk about performance, which is something that I get a lot of enjoyment out of. We'll talk about the Windows Assessment Toolkit, which I'm sure everyone is using on their physicals already. And Windows Assessment Services, which is what the OEMs use to make sure they give you a machine that works well. And then we'll talk about some third-party ideas on how to make sure our virtual desktops are working properly. So what is the session? The session is RDA, the Remote Desktop Services Product Group's guidance. We recently had a customer want to know what our stance was on one virtual CPU versus two versus three versus four, for example. And the answer is, it depends. It's like saying which color's the best, right? It depends, right? Taupe's very soothing, right? Learned that in Ocean's 11. So this is some guidance that we have. And then some field guidance based on MCS and field engineering. And again, it's guidance. And what this session is not, this session is not carved in stone. This is guidance, right? This is not a drill. And for Public Enemy fans, or Public Image Limited fans, this is not a love song. I love that song. All right, so performance and reliability updates. In Windows 8 and 8.1, sysmain became hypervisor aware. So what that means is that when we have a Windows 8 VDI guest, we don't need to disable the prefetcher and some other components of Windows. Windows will actually realize that he's an enlightened guest and will manipulate the prefetch cache, the boot cache, things like that, based on need for being in a hypervisor environment versus being in a physical environment. Not eating as much memory, for example, not eating as many IOPS, but still doing some good, right? There is a theory that we may come up with some SCS.
Do you want questions now or at the end?
Whenever. I'm open.
Did they make Defender anymore?
No. Defender's Defender. Yes. Good question. There are some thoughts that we might come out with some system center or security compliance manager guidance for virtual desktops so that when we run SCM against an image, we don't walk over the configuration recommendations of third parties and ourselves. I don't know if that's going to happen, but even Jeremy Moskowitz, I think that's how you pronounce his last name, he did a GPO pack for some of the VDI recommendations that we have. So you can apply those with GPO, although some of them don't make a whole lot of sense in group policy. You want them cooked into the image, particularly in a non-persistent pooled environment. A lot of those benefits are going to happen during a boot storm, not afterwards when GPO applies, right? With Windows 8 Update 1, the desktop experience, I think a lot of people shied away from Windows 8 as a VDI guest because of the modern interface and the confusion and the training and things like that for end users. Now we can manipulate Windows 8 to make it a well-behaved VDI guest for legacy applications, right? There are some surprises in 8 that I think you would be interested in. 8 has a smaller disk footprint and a smaller memory footprint than Windows 7 does in a virtualized environment by a substantial amount. So we'll talk about that. And then we'll also talk about, well, you know, there's also the group policies, management of the Microsoft store account, which is, again, one of those hurdles that enterprises just said, we don't want our end user buying an app and then having it cause a problem in our environment, things like that. So we can manipulate those through group policy or local policy to prevent the user from getting out of control from what the story is of the IT professional that's designing this experience. And you can do quite a bit with GPOs and local GPOs. And what you can't do with GPOs, you can do with procmon and changing the setting in the UI and seeing what happens. So, you know, just throwing that out there. So we talk about the build and image guidance, the thick, thin hybrid meets persistent, non-persistent pooled. What we're really looking at there is when you think about how we're going to build a virtual desktop infrastructure for our end users, what we don't want to be doing is taking the image we've been using for the last 5 years for our end users, popping it into a hypervisor and seeing what happens, right? That's a bad idea. All the agents, you know, you don't need things like remote assistant software necessarily, because if you need to get to the console, you can just fire up the hypervisor console and get to the console, right? You might not want the full antivirus running with the same rules that you would for a physical box. And one of the things that we talk about with one of my customers, I support a 30,000 user VDI farm, is the grain of sand that is a performance problem on a physical client, the user can get around, right? But when you take that grain of sand and you take 30,000 of them, and you stuff them all in the same infrastructure, that becomes a problem, right? And it becomes a problem in a way that's very hard to troubleshoot and to get to the bottom of, because you're not looking for something big, you're looking for something very small that's just under a microscope, right? If that makes sense. We'll talk about app provisioning a little bit and then the guidance here. So you have to think. That's the only image I could find. There isn't any free images of Aretha Franklin. I'm sorry, I couldn't swing it. But you have to think about what you're gonna be doing here, right? The thick, thin hybrid model, different applications and different use cases, you're gonna be able to take the different philosophy of imaging and utilize those. It may not make sense in your environment and even in my customer's environment necessarily for all 30,000 users to use the same image, depending on how the apps are provisioned, right? So we talk about that. We have the thin, which is the OS in our patches, and then some people may consider Office being part of the thin image just because, you know, you have it in your EA, everyone uses it potentially, so why not throw it in there? The hybrid is where we get into maybe chucking in a couple agents. One of the ones I see people do is a unmanaged antivirus that has ADAT files. So when you lay the image down, you have some sort of protection for heuristics, even while the image is being, you know, installed, as opposed to waiting on the wire for that to happen and however long it takes for your antivirus to catch up. And then some common core apps. And then the thick image is everything. I've actually seen customers do a thick image, deploy it, and then run an uninstall script based on the use case of the end user because of their deployment model. It actually made sense. Think low bandwidth, right? So they couldn't replicate a lot of changes for a lot of different images and things like that, and their users were all scattered all over the place in different work groups. So what they did is they just built an image with everything, and then for the licensing considerations, as the image was laid down, if it was for accounting, the HR apps were actually stripped out of the image during install. It's a way to do it, right? And then the pooled versus non-pooled, we kind of ripped this slide off from the old RDS thing, but you know, just to give you an idea of when does it make sense to have a pool of virtual desktops versus dedicated. And dedicated, you really have to question yourself at some point, why are you doing dedicated? Why not just give them a physical box? What are you gaining necessarily by having a dedicated pool of machines that they log into this box and you have to service it just like it's a physical box and apply patches monthly, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The life cycle of a machine in my customer's environment is about 7 days. It breaks, something goofy happens with it, they log out, it gets thrown away, all their data is saved, and we log in, they get a new machine. That's the pooled scenario, right? Where we don't care that someone wrote a bad app that has a memory leak, because when the user can't use it anymore, they log out of their session, take a coffee break, when they log back in, they've got a brand new session that's pristine, just like it was the last time they logged in. Is that good? It's good for uptime, maybe, right? But is it good from a coding perspective when if your app has a memory leak that's so severe it can't stay up for a week, what else does it do right? Is it calculating derivatives? I don't know. I mean, you know, it's like your antivirus. If your antivirus has a memory leak, well, does the filter driver work? Is it detecting viruses? I mean, crap, you know, I mean, how hard is it to make you know, something that doesn't have a memory leak? So if we have memory leaks, what else is wrong with the product? So in a way, it's masking it, but when you think about this large wholesale movement of users using thin clients, like say tellers in a bank, they don't need a desktop. They need to connect to one app and process people's information all day long, and then they're done. Well, who cares if that teller machine lasts a day? Doesn't matter. So when we look at application provisioning, if we're not doing a thick image with everything, including the kitchen sink included in the image, we have to take a look at it from how do we dynamically provision applications based off the use case, right? So this is where AppV, whether it's our product or another product, comes into play. We're doing a lot of registry virtualization and mirroring at this point for all of our legacy apps to pretend that they all have the one kernel or one hive, right, when they're doing their installation. so we don't have to serially install them during the user logon. That can get a bit hairy. I've seen that be pretty bad, actually. But the story's getting better. There are some limitations with application virtualization, that you need to be aware of, though. One of the limitations is we don't support you getting more than one version of Internet Explorer in a client, right? That's a bit of a problem when you have all these legacy apps or, you know, websites and things like that, that, well, this one renders in IE6, fine, this one renders in this, blah, blah, blah. Well, that's where enterprise mode comes in. I had a friend of mine actually ask me the other day, you know, did we have some secret code name for enterprise mode for Internet Explorer that was, you know, fix your damn app? And it's like, no, we don't have that secret code that I know of. But really, enterprise mode, for those that aren't aware of it, it's basically a place where you can give a list of URLs, and these have to be run in this compatibility mode. Okay, enterprise mode. Because your apps don't work necessarily. You know, you have things that are still running on IIS6, things like that, and go to the business and tell them you need to spend $10 million to upgrade it when it works. That's a hard sale, right? So we all end up with these skeletons in our closet, so how do we move forward and still support the past? And that's where AppV can play a part, and enterprise mode certainly helps. RDS, I've seen that be used also, so we're actually using remote desktop services to serve apps into a VDI infrastructure. A little counterintuitive, those are for kind of specialized apps, right? Applications that, well, I mean, it could be anything, but typically I see that happen when it's a small cluster of users where it's like, well, you know, it's 30 of them. We don't want to bother cooking in the image. We don't want to package it. We don't want to make it an AppV sequence. Just install it in a firm of servers and let them RDS to it. Who cares, right? You know, usually that's what happens to like accounting and HR, right? Because it's usually a small department and, you know, it's just easier to do that way. Modern apps currently are a bit of a pickle in VDI. Does anyone know why? Yeah, they install in the user profile. Well, kind of, right? If you remember the old Saturday Night Live skit, it's a floor wax and a dessert topping, right? So they install partly in the user profile and partly on the system. So when you do a pooled infrastructure environment, every time the user gets a new VM, all their modern apps have to install again. Not really the best experience, right? Not that it takes a long time or anything like that, but you know, that's a lot of downloading from the internet and updating and things like that. A little bit of a frustration. I think that's some of the reason we haven't seen 8 in modern apps get adopted in a virtualized environment, because, well, it's kind of a not broken scenario, but not really an optimal one, right? I think that story is getting better. We've certainly brought it to the attention of folks that can do something about it, so that's being looked at. And then the third-party application provisioning, you know, different types of AppV. I've even seen antiviruses that run as a VM on the machine and things like that, really kind of odd. There's a stack from one of our ISVs that basically virtualizes the entire registry for the operating system in every app and keeps a shadow copy of every single registry hive. And if you have an app that, you know, you have multiple apps that all talk to HKEY Current User, you might have like 15 copies of HKEY Current User. And now it's keeping track of each one of those for each version of, you know, these different apps. And there's a little bit of a performance penalty with that, right? I mean, you know, for everything that you're doing here, you're rendering it in software, there's a CPU hit for it. So then you have to scale your infrastructure for that experience. And we're going to talk about CPU in just a bit. That can be kind of a big deal, particularly with ESX in VMware. So antivirus, you can run the live client. It is a performance hit. It's kind of an ugly one. It doesn't scale well. Hyper-V, we don't have any kind of agentless, you know, thing that runs in the hypervisor yet that scans the individual clones and all that stuff. You'd have to actually run an agent in every single one of them. So one of our arguments is, do you need to, say, scan the operating system on reads? Probably not, because when you made the gold image, you probably scanned it. So why bother spending the cycles of scanning that every time you read NTOS kernel? It's a good argument. particularly if you're in an environment where you throw away the clone every 30 days and build a new image, as opposed to doing Windows updates, right? So if you're always building a new image, always building a new gold image, always scanning it, save yourself some IOP load. Why not? If you can sell it to your security department. I mean, you know, you tell them, well, we're not going to scan C:/Windows, and their heads catch on fire. But it's actually a valid argument. Why not? Sure, scan on write, why not? But on read, maybe you don't need to. So when we look at the impact of our, that's weird. I thought I had another slide in there. My bad. We look at the impact of our decisions on the end user, and we look at the cost associated with doing business in a virtualized environment. Testing needs to be done. I think the days of throwing something into a VM and seeing how it goes are long past for most of us, and at least if we like our jobs. So the Windows ADK has some tools in it that you can use to vet out your image. I actually do this like once every 6 months with one of my customers. We'll go on site and it's like, okay, well, we're looking at adding this piece of security software, or we're looking at making this configuration change, or this antivirus vendor came out with a new version of their filter engine. And we'll vet out each one of those changes. And it's like, here's the improvement or the lack of improvement, right? Or the penalty of making these changes on the image. Because when you're scaling that 30,000 times, even just a 5% hit to performance can kill you. And so we've actually found some good nuggets. Like we had the DLP software get implemented with no configuration settings, just the default out of the box config. And it's like, whoa, we're like double boot time with this one piece of software. About 50-60% more IOPS. If we need to do this, that's cool, but let's go buy some disks, right? Or some more flash storage, or whatever we need to do to scale this out if this is the cost of doing business for us. You can scale this out to physical environments as well, where if you're running a nuclear test center, what's the cost of doing loopback processing? Well, who cares? You can try and make it efficient, but ultimately you still need to run it so the group policies all get applied before the user logs in, so they have a secure experience, right? So a lot of these tools are going to help you with vetting out the cost of things like the filter drivers. What's the cost of updating this, of changing this? Now, what we found is that some antivirus vendors, when they update the DAT files, will update the DLLs and the engine on you without telling you. And the version doesn't even change, but the date does. What's up with that, right? So we've actually found that to cause performance hits on occasion that we couldn't explain because they weren't part of our test matrix. And then we go back in, gather some traces. I'm going to talk about how to collect traces and how to make a feedback loop that your end user can actually have an experience in, where you can go in and pull this data and harvest it and say, okay, here's what we need to do on image number 9, number 10, number 11, to constantly improve the environment, right? So Windows Assessment Toolkit is kind of like a one-off toolkit for analyzing performance. Windows Assessment Services is kind of the larger scale one that OEMs will use. And then there's some third-party systems you can get that we'll talk about briefly. And then there's an idea I have that you might want to implement on your own that would be free, except for labor. So this is what the Windows Assessment Toolkit looks like in a nutshell. You fire it up on a machine, you pick your test cases, you execute them. One of the options you have is actually to container your test case into a CAB file and give it to an end user and let them run it for you. It's not bad. You could actually make this part of your troubleshooting for level 3, level 4 help desk. It's a free tool, why not? So you package up, okay, you say your boot times are bad. Well, let's do the performance boot analysis. We'll wrap it up into a CAB file. Here, double-click this. They run it. It plops a zip file on their desktop. You go and harvest it. You're done. It even gives you a canned report that tells you what it thinks is wrong at the end, so you don't have to be an expert in performance to look at it. Being an expert doesn't hurt, but, it's all a learning experience. So that's free, right? And pretty easy to implement. You install the ADK on a Windows client, and it's one of the options in a checkbox. Fire it up, start playing with it, check it out. This is what the results actually look like. So if we look at it from a Windows 7 box, I think I have a laser pointer on here, don't I? Maybe I don't. Oh, yeah, I do. Well, okay, anyway. But yeah, see here, it's detecting that there's a driver that it doesn't think you actually need. I mean, do you guys check this stuff when you roll out an image to production? Does everyone run driver verifier and see if their machine's going to blue screen on their end users first? Right? Yeah? Everyone? No? Okay. Well, that's cool. I mean, you know, guinea pigs, why not? You know, end users. But you know, it goes through and gives you a menu of items that it thinks are wrong with the box. So one of the environments that I worked with, we would run verifier on it. They ran a bunch of medical imaging and equipment. And ATI, I don't know if you guys know this, but ATI actually opens up the API for writing video drivers. So if you need to analyze, like, you know, an MRI, you can make a card, you know, using ATI's chips, make your own driver using their SDK, and sell it to people. Well, that's cool, but then you have to get into that whole support model, right? Where, like, when your driver has a bug, you issue an update. Well, that doesn't happen so often with these guys. So we would actually run verifier on it, and it's like, well, you know, you guys need to look at these MRIs. That's cool, but it's going to blue screen your box like 20% of the time you open an image. You know, so be ready for that. Run it in a VM. I don't know. Do something. But yeah. So with that, it's time for the daily demo. Hopefully it'll work. Number 6 here. Windows Assessment Toolkit looks like this. And you can see in here, we've got a variety of test cases. It inventories what operating system they'll run on, what architecture. So this is kind of cool. What if you're doing a bake-off between the different OEMs and you want to see who's giving you the best deal on the hardware? This is the way to do it, right? So go in and pick your test cases out. Like if we want to do hardware performance, that runs on 8 and RT. So you just go in. Oops, yeah. Hardware performance actually consists of a memory footprint and a file handling. So it has two test cases, and it's going to go through and run generic things. Now, if you click here for package, it's going to roll it up into a cab file that I can ship off to one of you guys and have you run on your box instead. And when you're done, I can just go in to my options and import the results of that test run, which is pretty cool. Now, if I do any of these, it's probably going to mess up my machine because I just updated the video driver, but we can fire one up. You know, why not? Whatever. So let's say we want to do something quick. Browsing experience will take an hour, probably not. 2 hours, 1 hour. Well, that'll probably blue screen. We get the idea, 20 minutes. But you fire up one of these guys, and essentially what it's going to do is take ownership of the machine. It's going to install a local administrator account and act like a virus and run some tests, collect the ETW data, and then export out the data. It's called using a dumper command. So it's going to dumper out the data from the ETL trace, which is really hard to read, into XML and CSV, which is very easy to read, and then parse it through an XML filter and say, here's what's wrong. Pretty cool for free. Now this is the minor one, right? Just the one for individual use. So that's pretty cool. And if we go back, I meant to install that on a VM, but I couldn't get the VM to see the network, so we'll do the Windows Assessment Services in real time, though. So Windows Assessment Services, I have a bunch of deck material to bore you with, but let's do this one here. This is my Windows Assessment Server, and these two VMs are what I want to run my test case on. And actually, the Windows 7 ones I've blown away, so let me get rid of those guys. So what we've got here, maybe I should, well, I turned off enhanced mode. We'll see. So I've got here a test case, and right now it's going to do full boot, which actually works on Windows 7, so you can vet out your Windows 7 image performance with it. But that takes like 2 hours, so we're actually going to remove that guy. And we're going to get rid of file handling, because that takes a while. And I'm going to show you what the browser performance looks like. This runs on 7 and 8 because it requires, I think it's IE 10 or 11. I think it's IE 10. It requires IE 10 APIs to be present. So it's as simple as taking this, telling it to run. Demo, please don't crash. There's our two victims. Now, if we go to them, we can cheat. Let's see what happens to them. All right. Go back to our Windows Assessment Console, and it didn't work. Yay. Network connectivity issues, it figures. All right, well, fine. Let's see how it's going to be. Give me a second. We'll fix this. This should have worked on IPv6 automatically, but I don't have DHCP on this network, so we'll do 192.168.1.1. Yep. Okay. And we'll give him an IP and see if that fixes it. If it doesn't, we'll skip on to the boring deck. This worked at home, I promise. Yes. The last time I did this was at Tech Ed in Amsterdam, and it blue screened on me. So, I actually wasn't going to do this, and someone said it was lame if I didn't try it. So, it was like a double dog dare you, right? So, all right, so let's see. One of these should work now that I gave him an IP address. Maybe. Nah, bombed out. Okay, that's fine. If you were on a real network with naming resolution, it would work. I promise. And this is what it looks like. I did a test on my machine at home, which is a Core i7 something, 3770K, I think. And I was trying to test out one vCPU versus two, right? What's the difference? In Hyper-V, we get more horsepower out of it. In ESX, there's an argument that, someone here is probably more familiar with than I am, where if you oversubscribe your CPUs in ESX land, it actually costs you a performance penalty, right? It does, yeah, see? Thank you, that validation. But yeah, you see here, so here's my x86 guy, and here's my x64 guy. Or no, I'm sorry, these are two x86s, I can't see that far. And the one on the left is one vCPU. The one on the right is two vCPU. So we can display almost 1,000 more snowflakes in our HTML5 renderer. That's cool. One of the things that my customer uses their VDI for is people that watch the news. And they don't have, they're on ESX4, I think. So they don't have video cards offloading and all that stuff. And that experience is pretty poor. Hyper-V actually does a bit of a better job with it where we can do synthetic virtual GPUs, right? So it's kind of like the old, 3D rendering in software that you used to do when you're playing video games like Doom and Castle Wolfenstein, right? But this is one of the tests it'll run where it'll actually render out snowflakes. And then the fishbowl test, you can see about 30 more fish at 60 frames a second, because that's important too. So it locks it at 60 frames and then says, well, how many fish can we do at 60 frames? And this is not with RemoteFX enabled. This is just, running Windows 8 Hyper-V. Now, I talk about the PFE script. We haven't really gotten to it yet, but I wanted to show you what an optimized image versus a non-optimized image looks like. What's the footprint look like? If we just take the OEM DVD, pop it into a machine, Say, here you go, here's your Windows 7 or Windows 8 install. What does it look like? So this is Windows 7, I think. Unless it says differently. Two core, x86, x64, non-optimized, so the script has not been run, optimized, fish in the fishbowl. So the x86 is about even, right? 61 versus 59. But the x64 is actually quite a bit of a gain. Cool. So what did the script do? Did a bunch of stuff. It's pretty cool. Another thing, one of the things that people are always concerned about in VDI implementations is the IOP load, right? How much IOPS are we consuming during, say, a boot storm? This is the boot of an optimized versus non-optimized. We're actually loading less data off the disk by about 60, 70 meg, something like that, right? The service times go down too. So we spend less time doing it, we load less, and the IO times are lower. So overall, it's a better experience. Now remember, we're looking at grains of sand here. Is the difference really worth doing? Well, on one machine, no. But if you want to stuff 50 of them on one box, yeah, it's worth it, right? Question? No, it's all good. So same thing here on Windows 7 SP1. The difference is pretty big. We load about 100 less meg, which is about 30, 40% of the load of our I/O. We turned off a bunch of stuff. And then here you're looking at the file copy handling. I thought this one was pretty interesting too. So again, on the right-hand side for you, non-optimized Windows 7 and optimized Windows 7, it takes less time for our end user to do file copy operations. Why? We turned off stuff that wasn't needed. Maybe it's needed on a physical box, or maybe it doesn't matter it's present on a physical box, but in a virtualized environment, it does matter, right? Everyone always wants to go in and turn off services and tweak the operating system and make it run better and all that stuff. That's really what these scripts do. And as you go from 7 to 8, they change different things. And then hopefully in 9, this will all be built in to where it says, hey, I'm a hypervisor machine. I'm in VDI. I'm going to run this template. Maybe. Then here's the browsing experience, optimized versus non-optimized. So again, we're seeing good performance gains. This is in the Windows Assessment Services console. So we can actually go in, run the test versus different types of hardware, physical, virtual, tablet, RT, VDI, dedicated, run all those tests, and then do comparative analysis against them. We could also do things like, well, what's the difference of this developer having a desktop versus having a laptop? Does it matter? Well, it probably does. I'm sure it would. But again, you know, form factor and all that stuff too. But you look at, is the SSD worth it? I mean, yes, it is, trust me. But this will help you prove the SSD is worth it. Same type of deal, snowflakes. So that's our guidance, and I'll show you in a minute. But what do you do when you're looking at things like Microsoft's guidance, Citrix guidance, VMware guidance, and then some blog you read on the internet? Right? Because I've actually had critsits where it's like, well, you know, this guy wrote this blog post and it seemed pretty legit, so you know, we went in and did it, and that's why you're here. So undo it, right? Why am I here? But I've actually emailed people saying, hey, you know, could you take that down? You know, no offense, you know, A for effort, but could you please take that down? We found when we started doing a lot of VDI and field engineering, that VMware was recommending things like disabling the Windows firewall service. Does everyone still do that? Turn off firewall service, yeah? Totally unsupported, breaks a bunch of stuff. Turn off UAC, unsupported, right? Totally unsupported. VMware wants to dedupe the kernel memory of the guests so they can show that you can squeeze more guests into the footprint of a host, right? So what do they tell you to do? They tell you to turn off address space layer randomizations. Everyone know what that does? That's what randomizes the loading of the kernel to prevent dictionary or library attacks, I think is what they're called, right? Where the binary always loads in the same address every time, so then you can just run a command against it when you have a buffer overrun. Well, we randomized that in Vista. Well, they want you to turn that off so they can dedupe that kernel memory, which good for them, bad for you, right? So Citrix, we found, actually was kind of mellow in their guidance. They tended to not go far enough in things you could turn off and still be supported. VMware did things like turn off the Windows Firewall service, and then one of the things when you called in for support was, why are you doing that? Turn that back on, and then we'll help you, right? So the idea that we had was to come up with some guidance. That's actually bad guidance, hang on. So the idea we had is to come up with some guidance that would help you with being in a optimized but supported realm, where when you call into us, it's not, hey, redo this, hey. I mean, I was just on a thread the other day where we told the customer, you need to redo everything in Hyper-V or physical before I'll help you anymore. I mean, you know, from the escalation engineer sitting on the other end of the phone, cool, right? I mean, he needs you to do that. From the operational perspective, how do you go to your manager and say, yeah, so, you know, this whole thing we spent like millions of dollars on the last 3 years of effort? Yeah, not working out so well. We need to undo all of it so we can troubleshoot. I mean, no, right? You like your job, you want to keep it, right? Yeah. This is one of the guidances also. We've had people that want to implement security guidance based on XP world, XP time frame. I want to go in and, I mean, who hasn't wanted to go in and change the default viewer for VBS script to Notepad? So if someone double clicks, because you know end users, oh, hey, someone loves me, let me double click that. And they run a VB script, right? So let's change that to Notepad so it opens up in Notepad. What does that do to your login script during logon? It takes 10 minutes to log on because Notepad opened in session zero and it's sitting there waiting for you to close it. And it's a 10-minute timeout by default. So we came up with this KB, and it's in the notes of the presentation, that basically going in and tinkering with some of this stuff is generally a bad idea, and if you're doing it, you probably shouldn't be, unless you have a really good reason, right? This is part of the reason we came up with Security Compliance Manager, SCM, was to give people templates for, I want a secure environment that won't do things like shoot me in the foot. And we had a PFE write this. It's basically the reasons you don't want to be unique in IT. It's a fun read, a lot of truth in it, but a lot of people aren't really thinking when they implement things necessarily. Like, you know, I had the company that just took their physical image and popped it into VMware and said, well, we'll just see what happens. And then they never touched it and it doesn't work real well. And it's like, come on, work with me here. But the VDI stuff. So, you guys still run Windows 7 mainly for VDI? Yeah? Pretty much everybody? Yeah? There's a wiki, the list of resources for Windows 7 optimization. Our scripts are on it. Also, the scripts to VMware and Citrix are on there, right? So you can go in and compare things, take notes, take a look at it. That's the one that myself and Carl Liberti wrote, and that link is in the notes also. So what are we doing? We're turning off services that don't make any sense in a VDI environment, like the universal plug-and-play service. Really? I mean, does the checkpoint firewall say, oh, you want to open that port? Yeah, let's go ahead. No, I mean, come on. SSDP. You're not going to look for a wireless router in a VDI farm. So we don't need that. So, you know, we go through and just turn off things that make sense to turn off. Lower the footprint, boot faster, better experience, lower IOPS, less CPU load. And you can see it in the Windows Assessment Services on one of the images, clear as day. It also, I mean, it boots a ton faster. When you run these tests, it boots 6 times to massage the prefetcher, and the optimized image will be done, and your non-optimized will be out like run 3. That's how much of a difference it is in boot time change. VDI for Windows 8, this, is anyone here disabling the task scheduler service? It's another big no-no, right? The task scheduler is where a lot of stuff goes that people don't know where to put it. Just my interpretation of it, right? So in this script, if you go through and look at it for Windows 8, there are a lot of scheduled tasks we turn off. Did you know if you turn off the defrag service, your defrag will still run in Windows 7? Because it's being called by a scheduled task. It has nothing to do with the service running. Take a look at it. So in here, On Windows 8, there's a lot more that's being done in scheduled tasks that we go in and turn off for VDI. And our scripts are mainly geared towards pooled, non-persistent, right? So we're actually making an effort right now to change things for update one and to take a consideration in what if it's a non-pooled, persistent environment, what should we leave on? Fair enough. New command in Windows 8. Everyone's familiar with this, right? Reset base and start component cleanup. What this does is make the last Windows updates that have run on your machine permanent and gets rid of all the previous ones that you could uninstall. In a non-persistent VDI environment, who's going to uninstall a hotfix? It just makes no sense, right? So you go in and run this command, and you reduce the x86 install base by 190 meg, you reduce the x64 one by 600 meg. So less work for the dedupe engine to keep track of. It's good. This is with my test harness, by the way. So I took just the size of the Windows directory. So Windows update one, x64 was about 10.9 gig after running that command, and 7.3. I took them out, but in Windows 7, this number is like 21, and this one's about 18. 7's a lot fatter. I don't know why, I didn't go through and look DLL for DLL, but 7 and 8, there's a thinner footprint. There's a theory, is everyone familiar with boot to WIM in Windows 8.1? Where you, like, it's made for little tablets, right? So you take a tablet with an 8 gig hard drive and you boot off the WIM instead of booting off an install of Windows. Well, there's a theory that you could do that in VDI as well, right? And then you're just deduping the WIM. Well, in theory, the WIM should be the same for everybody, so it's one big dedupe. Kind of looking into that now, playing with it. Don't do that at home. Well, you can't do it at home. Don't do it in production, right? Third party, so SysTrack. Lakeside SysTrack, logon VSI. I had some content for these guys. It wasn't very good, so I got rid of it. But I recommend encountering these guys. Normally, these guys are at TechEd, so they probably are. I came in last night, I don't know. And then Stuff. So Stuff's my idea. What if you built an engine, and all this content, or most of this content already exists, what if you built an engine that constantly recorded an ETW trace and a network trace in the background of every user in your environment? Or what if it's just decimated to one out of every 10 or one out of every 20 in your environment, or one per rack or one per host? And when that user complains that that production is bad, they have a button to push that stops those traces. Well, you just have the recording of the last 5 to 10 minutes of what happened in production on that box. If you're in ESX or Hyper-V, you could even, which you're going to be in one of them, right? You could even call to make a VSS snap or a snapshot of the VM and then convert it to a memory dump. Everyone knows how to do that, right? Do a search for it. It's pretty easy. So you could have the end user trigger a full memory dump of their VM plus the ETW trace, the last 5 minutes of activity of the user mode space, the kernel mode space, and the network activity on that box. Well, now when the user complains, right? When the user complains, you actually have data. It's not a, well, how often does this happen? Do I really want to look at it? I wanted to go to lunch right now. Maybe they should just reboot and it'll go away. You know, I mean, you actually have a bundle of data that's packaged up, that's there for you, that's probably going to be authoritative on what happened in that environment. What if you then took that data and dumped it out using some of the XML stuff that's in Windows Performance Toolkit and Windows Assessment Services and Windows Assessment Toolkit, pumped it into a directory, ran a PowerShell, automated the analysis, piped it out to a web root or a SQL reporting server. And then you could go through and figure out, okay, well, this app stinks, or this add-in from this OEM or this vendor stinks. We need to get them to fix this so we can go in and make our image better, and then it's that constant cycle of improvement. Does that make sense? Now, everyone has time to implement this, right? Yeah? Yeah. That's the problem. Everyone's understaffed. do more with less, right? Maybe I'll just quit and make this, sell it. I don't know. Anyway, but yeah, this is an idea. We're one of my customers, we're trying to implement something like this, where we don't need to wait to collect data after the issue occurs. Now think about this from a server farm environment as well. If you're collecting ETW data, collecting a snap, and collecting a network collection of what happened on a server, that's just as powerful. I mean, how many times have you had to call in the support and the first thing they say is, well, is it happening now? Well, no. Did you collect any data? No. All right, well, when it reproduces, you're not set up for a memory dump. So reset yourself up for memory dump, reboot, wait 30 or 40 days for it to reproduce, then call us back. Well, this is a better way to do it, particularly if it's a VM. You can just take a snap of the running system and make it a memory dump. You have to analyze it a little differently, but it's easy to do. I do that for all my customers. So I blogged a couple years ago, I think. I'm getting old. How to collect a netmon 3.4, an xperf kernel trace, run it in a circular format, and then when a problem occurs, how to stop it. So that part's written for you already. It's actually really easy. It's a couple command lines, and then it eats up a little bit of memory. Now, don't do it on every machine that's in the environment, but if you do it on 1 out of 10 or 1 out of 20, who cares, right? What's a couple hundred meg? Where'd the rest of my deck go? Dude, where's my deck? Is that it? That isn't it. All right, I'm missing part of my deck. I'll make sure we get fixed for that. Questions? Does this make sense to anybody? Does everyone think I'm high? Is it totally unrealistic to try and do this in production? What do you think? You want me to be quiet and you can listen to Dwayne Allman some more? You know? Any questions? Bueller, anyone? Voodoo economics? What's that, I'm sorry? Oh, you're talking about the RDP client. Yes, works very well. The new RDP client, if you stream video using the new RDP client, it takes about half the bandwidth for the same quality. With or without what? I want to say it's the RDP protocol. It's the CPU load on the back end that you end up eating. But you can do the software virtualized GPUs, right? And just, it's a CPU cost. Yeah. But the RDP protocol, I don't know what they did, but they did something. I'm not a developer. But yeah, I'm really bummed this didn't work. Oh, wait. You know what? It might work. Hang on. Let me see if I can make this work for y'all real quick. We're going to change you to that. Bump, bump. Yeah. Yeah, you are. Do you still have that? Let me undo my silliness. All right. Go into this guy. Do the same thing. We'll run it on their production network. Why not? All right, so now these guys should all see each other in theory. All right, so let me try and run this. Give it something else just so we see it. Not started. It might work. Doesn't look like it's going to. Yeah. Oh, action required. Let's cancel this guy first. Yeah, it's cranky. But yeah, watching this thing run is pretty slick, where you can have it run driver verifier, Does everyone keep their drivers and firmware up to date in the enterprise? I mean, how hard is that, right? But at least you can come out with it with SCUP, like, once a quarter, or do a spring cleaning once a year, something like that. But with this, you can actually validate, do they matter? And the console, if I go back to my jobs, we can see what one of them looks like here. So if I go in here and view the results, so here's the data I collected, right? Scroll down here. The UI leaves a little be desired, but you know, whatever. And you click on the graph style. But yeah, it'll even look for DWN, the Desktop Windows Manager. It'll look for faults, and if it occurs, how many of them have occurred. And that's going to be things like, you know, we made a DirectX call that we couldn't humor using the you know, built-in video adapter because we're not running RemoteFX in VMware, something like that, right? Now, that doesn't mean that it would have crashed, but it might have hitched. And one of the photo rendering test will actually, and actually so will the modern test for the modern UI, it'll tell you whether the movements of the individual test items were quick enough in milliseconds to where the human wouldn't notice the delay, right? So if it takes 10 milliseconds for me to do that, that's probably okay. But if it takes 50 milliseconds, I might wonder what the heck's going on. Oops, like that, there. Well, it helps you hit the right button, but you get the idea. Now the Windows Assessment Toolkit, same type of deal. You know what, I'm gonna start the Internet Explorer one, so we'll just make him run. Oh, power's not set to balance, la-di-da. Start. I'm doing nothing, don't interact with the computer. So it's running a utility called AXE, A-X-E. And you can see it referenced up at the top, A-X-E. So it's running AXE, and then AXE is basically a compiled binary that you can throw XMLs at and run various test cases. So that's the test case engine, sort of like a virus, but not malignant. And if we give him enough time, he's gonna go fire up one of the tests, like the HTML5 rendering, and see how well the machine does, which this has an actual video card, so it should run fairly well, right? So that was the start. One of the things it cares about is, if you have a bunch of add-ins in Internet Explorer, what's the cost of you starting Internet Explorer? You know, because add-ins, I mean, some of them could be pretty freaking heavy, particularly if you have kids at home, right? And they run like the Java, and you know, you have like 4,000 ads and 5 toolbars and all that stuff. But yeah, this is going to go through and run the tests, and of course it's going to take a while, but it's going to run a series of them, balance out, look for averages and all that stuff, and then tell you what it thinks the performance is. It doesn't give you an index, but if you run it between multiple machines, you can do a comparative analysis so easy, right? Like the new Intel CPUs that have the integrated GPU in them, right? Does that really cut it when you're running AutoCAD? I mean, you could laugh, probably not, right? But if you needed to know, this is how you could tell. So questions? You gonna go home and use this? It's actually pretty cool. The driver verifier test by itself is worth the time, in my opinion. Knowing what's gonna blue screen your end user's machines is gold. So what's it doing? Test 2 of 3. Yeah. Yes. Did you know, I think this is new in Windows 8, Michael Niehaus wrote a script on it. How do you extract the drivers from a Windows 8 install? It's a PowerShell script, right? So it's up on his blog. But you can just as easily mount the whim of an install and say, what drivers do you have? Oh, you have that? Well, I don't like that. Let's remove that. Or even updates. I think you can roll back updates in there too. As long as they're not superseded, right, with that, with the commands I listed before. Once you do that, it's permanent. But again, if you're applying all the regular Windows updates and you're throwing away your VMs in 20, 30 days, no one's gonna uninstall. Well, that was boring, it didn't do the little snowflake test. Oh, I have an issue. See, it doesn't like something. 300 milliseconds. So if we go in here, sure iterations, it was right here, so it's going to be this one. Now we can open the WPA trace. This is where it gets harder, right? And we can see what it was that caused the hang or the delay. Right there, it labels it for us. User perceived IE launch. That's how long it took to create the first tab, right there. So we need to go in and find out why that took that long. Was it disk? Was it CPU? Network? But it's all in there. Let me see if I can have it run one that actually looks cool, though, because I'm disappointed in that one. Run individual. Oh, that's the mini filter one. That's why it looked like crap. Okay. This is the one I wanted. Yes. Don't kill me. Okay, this should be more interesting. And you see it's gathering system information. So if I ran this on an AMD versus an Intel, with the GPU, with it not, all that stuff's recorded in the individual traces. So that all shows up in the inventory of each system. So it makes the comparative analysis super easy. Come on, do something cool. Want to be political about that. So the question is, are there any benefits on 7 versus 8, you know, with VMware versus Hyper-V and all that stuff? Oh, happy holidays. Nice. It is HTML5. So I don't know. You know, most of the shops I run into, honestly, for VDI are still using VMware because they have the I Love VMware bumper stickers, you know, on the back of their chairs and stuff. A lot of customers I see now, there we go. A lot of customers I see now are running into the oversubscription problem, right? Where they're having problems with, well, my users really only use about 1.2 CPUs, which is more than one, so I need two, but then the hypervisor eats a bunch of CPU, managing the overhead of giving them two CPUs and not consuming it. And so you end up with this, do I shaft the user, or do I shaft the business with density? And that's not a comfortable place to be, right? Is it done already? Is it still going? I think it's still going. That's weird. Anyway, but yeah, good question. I think that generally speaking, it's definitely worth giving Hyper-V a try to see what the differences are. I've always had this attitude. You look at the like when Citrix came out. Oh, let's just put everything in Citrix. And then, you know, you got your first SAN. Oh, everything should go in the SAN. You know, and you know, VMware came out, and oh, everything should go in a VM. And everything's a tool, right? It, you know, it's like the mechanic doesn't hammer with a wrench. Well, maybe he does. I do, but I'm not a good mechanic either. But it behooves us every now and then to take a step back and say, are we making the right decisions, or are we making the religious decision of what we're used to? Right? I'm a big fan of taking that step back and saying, you know, hey, are we still making the right decision? Like 7 versus 8. I mean, if you can get half the disk footprint of a Windows install in a VDI farm, wouldn't you want it? Go to 8. Do you want to run less memory per guest? Go to 8. Can your browser speed read? It's pretty cool. When this is done, I want to show you the memory footprint of my Windows 8 guests. The x86 one is like 680 meg. Now, it's not running Office or anything like that, but it's a full-blown patched Windows 8 install with a user profile. and it's eating 600 meg of memory. That's not bad. Versus Windows 7, where it's a bit higher, right? Let me interrupt this guy, if I can. Cancel job. Ah! I was close. There we go. But you see, the cool thing with this tool is that once you get your test collection of what you want to see, you can package it up as a cab file and send it to the end user and say, yeah, if that happens again, run this. I want to see what's going on before you reboot, right? So he's going to do the assessment of it now. But look at this. All right, you're misbehaving. Yes, you're done. There. There's my x86 Windows 8 install. And it actually only wants 539 meg. That's not bad. My video card has more RAM than that. Actually, my video card has 4 gig, so that's irrelevant. But yeah, you look at the X64 one. He wants less than a gig. That's pretty thin. So it leaves us room in memory for our apps versus the operating system, user profile, muck, stuff. Optimize your registry, buy this tool. Your computer has a virus, click this. Has anyone gotten the phone call? Hi, this is Microsoft calling. Yeah, I did. I got one. Unfortunately, I was on a conference call. So I get a call, answer it, put my conference call on hold. Yeah. Hi, this is Microsoft calling. You have a problem with your computer. And the first thing I think is, well, which one? Because I have 32 VMs running. But after I got through that, I was like, really? You know. I mean, I wanted to stand up a VM and let them mess with it just so I could forensic it and see what was going on, but I was on a conference call, so I had to ditch them. But I know people that have fallen for that. You know what that does, right? They encrypt all your files and then charge you a fee to decrypt them. Yes, CryptoLocker. Those are the people that call in and claim to be Microsoft. And they get people in rural areas and older folks and stuff like that all the time. It's disgusting. All right, any questions? But do you see, I mean, Windows 8, try it out, particularly with the desktop mode, you know, if you have legacy apps, yeah. Yeah, dynamic. Well, this is enabled for dynamic memory, right? So my startup memory for this guy, 2 gig. So during boot, I'll placate the operating system, let him have 2 gig. And then when he's done, tether that back, give me that memory back. I want to play a video game. Give me that memory, right? So I set a floor, and that's the default 512. And then the max, I went ahead and made the maximum be the same as what it has at boot. But you can see, and then you can also allocate a buffer. So the buffer is basically, if you know that you might all of a sudden page out the wazoo because they're going to open like AutoCAD, right, or a 400 meg PowerPoint, or you know whatever your end users do that are really silly. I had a guy try and back up his computer to a public folder in Exchange, so he could download it at home. Hey, thinking outside the box, that was really smart. But yeah, so if you have a user that does squirrely things, give them a higher memory buffer so it keeps an eye out and doesn't stutter them as it allocates more memory. Or if they're more important, change the memory weighting too, right? And then this can all be dynamically done in SCVMM, I'm almost positive. I need to fire that guy up again. I haven't in a couple years. But yeah, dynamic memory is one of our advantages, I think. And I mean, VMware has it with ballooning. You can actually see it. You know when you install the VMware editions, you get the VM memory and VM processor perf counters, right, in perfmon. One of those is memory ballooned. And is everyone a user of the tool PAL, Performance Analyzer of Logs? Yes? No? No? Okay. I wrote the VMware one for it. So PAL Clint Huffman, check this thing out. Let's see. Oh, he doesn't have any pretty pictures up. But yeah, if you do a search on this, it's one like top 20, you know, freeware tools on the internet with PC Magazine or whatever. He's won all kinds of awards with it. But PAL is a tool that it gives you a template that you can use to collect all the perf statistics that are important for a particular scenario, like an Active Directory server. And then when you're done with collecting the data, you run it back through the tool and it generates a web report of what all the performance problems are with it. I mean, it's not perfect, but no machine is, but I run it in the background when I'm analyzing stuff manually. But I made the template for VMware for this. So when you are on a VMware guest, we automatically assume you are, because there's no harm in trying to load a counter that doesn't exist. So we always assume you're in a VMware machine. We pull the counters, and then you can see the ballooning driver stealing memory away from you all day long, which is actually kind of cool. It's a neat experience to see that happen. That reminded me of something, actually. Oh, 5 minutes. PAL and VMware. Oh, if you guys are using VMware, how are you building your base image, your gold image? Are you building it in ESX? Or are you building it in VMware Workstation under someone's desk? Yeah. Yeah, good, good answer. I know people that don't. Do you know what happens? You end up with an image with a bunch of different versions of files for the tools. And I'm not saying that breaks things, but I'm definitely gonna say it's not a good idea. Yes? Yes. I think it's about 8,000 personal and the rest pooled. Shrink the disk? Yeah, so we don't give them the disk. Even on a persistent machine, they don't have the C drive. We still redirect the profile. It's on the NAS, right? So, okay, oh, I think I see what you're saying. So if they balloon up their profile, yeah. I don't think that we do anything for that right now, although we should. I don't think we do. I think we dedupe it, which catches white space, but we don't do what you're saying we should do. And yeah, we should. No. Politics, in my opinion. That's an unofficial answer. Unofficially. I think that when 8 first came out, Microsoft got a black eye for, some people would say that it was an arrogance of, here's the new way of using your computer. And in some companies, that was taken the wrong way by executives who haven't let go yet. Is that fair? Yeah? Yes, storage spaces with dedupe. Yeah. We are using a combination of SAN, NAS, and flash. Have you ever heard of the Ilios from Atlantis? Yeah, so basically we load the gold image into RAM and we service it off that, and then the users have differencing machines after that. Yeah. Which is certainly a way to do it. Yeah. Half the cost? That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, pooled's the way to go, right? I mean, like I was saying earlier, and you know, it's kind of tongue in cheek, right? But you know, if you're doing dedicated, why are you doing dedicated? And yeah, there's gonna be some reasons for it. But if you do the pooled, I mean, man, the cost savings and the leveraging of the infrastructure is huge. Yeah. That's one thing I didn't do because my lab is Windows 8 and I didn't dism in the dedupe engine to dedupe to show you what happens after you go in and do the superseded and, you know, basically clean up your WIM, right? And I mean, the thing I said about boot to WIM is not product group guidance at all, right? It's something that I've dreamed up that I want to do in a lab and see what happens. So, well, I don't think they're doing it yet on the surface.
No, I'm doing it on my
surface. Oh, you're doing it on your surface? Boot to whim? Yeah? Do you see a perf penalty?
Haven't noticed any at all.
I bet. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, disk space is a big deal, for sure. Yeah, we're not supposed to talk about that, but I will. You can dism in parts of the operating system, and one of the things you can do is enable dedupe in your lab if you're running Windows 8, but you're not supposed to, because what happens if you apply a hotfix? Did it fix that or not? Probably not, right? So totally unsupported, don't do it in production, but it's kind of cool when you're lugging around this and you need to have 30 VMs. So anyway, any other questions? Yeah, go ahead. Right. It's like the Brian Madden book, right? Have you guys read the Brian Madden book with the cover where it's the screw that's bent and the hammer, right? The VDI delusion. Yeah, my opinion is if the number one driver of VDI implementation for you is cost savings, it's probably not a story for success. But if you're doing it to enable BYOD, to enable some flexibility in multiple data centers, if you're doing it for disaster recovery, I mean, you guys know about the remote desktop thing we just released in Azure, right? I mean, what happens if, you know, it floods somewhere or it snows somewhere and everyone needs to work at home? Well, you can just spin up a bunch of Azure instances and let them do it. And then when you're done with it, you just throw it away. How cool is that? I mean, the whole pay-as-you-go thing really shines in that kind of environment where it's like, I mean, I remember back in .com era, everyone needed SunGuard or, you know, Exodus or whatever, and you would actually do a DR exercise and they would have 400 machines for your employees of your .com, and you would roll your image out and you would do all that stuff. And what's the cost of having all that crap around, you know? Not that SunGuard's a bad company or, you know, whatever. But yeah, you know, there's certainly flexibilities there. But it depends on use case, totally depends on use case. But I think VDI's got, there are some real sweet spots for it that, you know, really shines for folks. As long as you do it right, right? Yeah. All right, well, I'm way over. But thank you. Any other questions? Feel free to come up. It's all good. Cool. Enjoy Tech Ed. There's a party tonight, right? Cool.